Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolokimab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network
on News Talk.
And this is the Pat Kenny Show with Anton in for Pat. It's some 50 years since man last walked on the moon, and missions to repeat Neil Armstrong's feat have been thin on the ground ever since. But NASA are launching another mission to the moon as part of a wider exploration of space. We go live now to Florida, where space reporter, educator and podcaster Niamh Shaw has all of the details. Morning, Niamh.
Morning, Anton. How are you? Greetings from NASA Kennedy.
It's a lovely thing to be able to say. How's the weather?
It's fine. I got absolutely soaked there when I came first. So I've got that. It's sort of very tropical here anyway. So it's always quite moist. So it's fine now. It's dry.
But I have that
kind of wet post-rain sort of soakage in my clothes.
You are there because you're monitoring the launch of Artemis 1.
Yeah.
Explain the logic of this, because I thought this was the definitive been there, done that. So what's the point in going back?
Well, it's part of a much, much, much bigger, much more ambitious strategy this time around. And it involves a lot of partners. Whereas before, you know, a big impetus of the last time why people got to the moon was it was really like a space race between Russia and America. But it's a much different climate now. Now there are many, many countries involved, and there are many businesses involved. And so NASA have really looked at the strategy, and they are cooperating with businesses. And they're subcontracting out different elements to make landers and rockets and all different components, and then pulling them all together. And what that allows them to do is it's much more cost effective, and it's a much more effective use of their labor and their research department. And this is the beginning of a very long kind of 30 to 50 year strategy to ultimately to orbit the moon the first time around. Second time around is to get humans to orbit the moon. The third Artemis mission is to get footprints on the moon, and then to develop a new space station called the Gateway to orbit the moon and to drop astronauts down for different science missions from time to time, purposely kind of targeting the southern hemisphere of the moon because they have discovered evidence of water there. So it's a good place if we are to prepare and build a lunar habitat, which would be a long-term kind of a research station or an orbiting outpost. And that all of that is really to help us navigate bigger aspirations, which is to repeat the same thing for the moon. So there's a whole lot of unknowns in all of that.
Sorry, to repeat the same thing for Mars, is it?
Yeah, but also just like spending that much time on the moon. Nobody really knows what that will do, because the furthest we've had long stay of humans outside of Earth has been on the International Space Station. And that's just 400 kilometers above us. It's very different when you have people orbiting the moon where there's no real protection from cosmic radiation or any solar storms. And then, you know, actually putting humans to live long term on the moon for science purposes. It's kind of like putting them in the Antarctic. But the Antarctic always has oxygen and it always has an atmosphere to protect us from radiation. The moon has neither, you know. So what does that do long term? So there's loads of questions and loads of opportunities for us then to bring answers and apply it back here on Earth, you know, in terms of living more sustainably, living more smartly, making better use of our energy and our waste. And so it's a massive long plan, and there are many spin-offs back for Earth, but also for us to kind of keep exploring further. So,
are those spin-offs sufficient to justify the cost, Niamh? Because if we go back to the first lunar missions, in part they were fueled by a desire to prove to the Soviets and vice versa that America had intercontinental ballistic missile capacity and it would be wise not to cause them to use it. And also to a degree to make points about scientific advancement in the US and create popular support. It doesn't seem that there is the same direct Cold War incentive to this. Is this just science for science's sake?
No, I don't think it's science for science's sake. It's definitely more cost effective by using commercial partnerships, which is, you know, private public partnerships, which is the main thrust of their business. The cost is drastically reduced. That's the first thing. But it's not just for science. There's always, when you're trying to do something that's never been done before, what happens is that answers emerge and from those answers, applications come. So, you know, from us being able to understand the impact of microgravity, that's kind of the feeling of the absence of gravity in our bodies. Other things have come to the fore, like being able to grow proteins more uniformly. So they're actually more effective medicines on the ground. Thanks to us spending 20 years orbiting the Earth, we've come up with MRIs, we've come up with more effective water filtration systems and air filtration systems and recycling and all sorts of like products that are spin-offs from the technology that had to be created in order for us to get to the moon the first time, in order for people to survive on the International Space Station. So I imagine the same thing will happen. But I guess, you know, when you say science for science sake, it's really just I guess I'm a scientist, so I'm always going to want to know what's over the hill. And, you know, NASA has also been involved in launching, you know, the biggest space telescope ever in order for us to understand our place in the universe. So I guess I'm always going to be pro science because I'm a curious person and I want to have answers. And it's important for us as humans to understand what happened to Mars in case it happened to us. It's important for us to understand, is there water on every planet or on every celestial object? And there seems to be. And if that's the case, where did we come from and what's our imprint in the overall scheme of things? And there is definite evidence of just even the landscape of Mars, that there used to be water on the surface. So what happened to Mars? And there is an atmosphere, but the atmosphere is a lot thinner. And so you can send rovers, which is what the Perseverance is there, and you can send helicopters. But there's something different about you can't instruct a rover to do the same thing that a human can do. So the best way of conducting science is always to get people there, and very remote places and very dangerous places. So we have to make sure that we protect these people. But also, when you think about building a home in an environment where there's no oxygen, there's very little gravity, there's no food, there's no electricity, there's no running water, you have to be very resourceful and think about how can we build a safe home for humans so that they have oxygen and they have water and they have food. And all of those solutions can be fed back into Earth for more sustainable living, you know, for long-term kind of development of housing estates that will be just basically like have zero carbon emissions from them, rather than it being the onus of us as public to come up with these solutions. If they become more mainstream and they're really solid solutions, there's nothing stopping governments and different construction firms being enforced to make sustainable homes. So all of that comes from research and science and moving forward. So I'm always going to be pro-science, because out of that comes solution. Initially, it's science, you know, some people say it's science for science sake, because we are trying to figure out these tiny answers to these bigger questions. But there's always applications at the end of the day for that, you know.
If I remember right, the Saturn V rocket, which was part of the run-up to the moon, was at the time, possibly since, but was at the time the single most powerful moving object that humanity had ever created. How does Artemis stack up by comparison?
It's slightly less tall, but it is actually more powerful than Saturn V. It's actually more powerful. And it has to be, because if they're going to be building a space station around the moon, this is the craft that's going to make it happen. So it has to be powerful. And the reason why Saturn V was also powerful is that to get a spacecraft to pull away from Earth's atmosphere, Earth's gravitational force, and out of the orbit of Earth, it has to be extremely strong. You have to have really, really powerful rockets to do that. But not only that, they have to travel a great distance. They have to travel over 300,000 kilometers, should I say. It's the average distance between Earth and the moon is 384,400 kilometers. So that's very different from trying to get something to leave Earth and just head up 400 kilometers above us and then orbit Earth, still at like 22,000 kilometers per hour. But so it's extremely powerful for a reason. And this is the first generation of a third generation of rocket that they want to create, which will be even bigger and be able to take heavier payloads. And this is a strategy from NASA from a commercial point of view, is that they want this rocket to be the rocket that can bring heavier payloads, the heaviest payloads possible, into space, in order to construct space stations and whatever else people feel if they have the money to buy a space on the SLS rocket. So
I need to ask you one thing, Niamh, before I let you go, which is, despite obviously there being mirrors on the moon surface that prove that there were people up there, there's a cottage industry of those who go back through the video footage and explain why the shadows are wrong and the flag looks wrong and all the rest of it. What is your expectation of conspiracy theorists off the back of this mission?
I think it'll be very difficult for them, because there's cameras all over this spacecraft. I mean, Orion, the capsule, what's going to happen is this rocket, the Space Launch System, is going to propel the payload, which is like the deliverable, which is the Orion capsule, which is what astronauts are going to use to eventually, get to the moon and land on the moon. So there's cameras all over the Orion capsule. So they're promising us that within a few hours after launch, the Orion is going to be sending back images of it actually orbiting Earth. It's going to use an orbit of Earth to propel itself, a bit like a push of a swing, in order to be then to kind of speed up, using the force of gravity then to kind of boomerang itself across to the moon. So all of that, we're going to get footage of that, we're going to get video of that. So I'm not really sure how you can fake that moment to moment. And it might finally put to bed the people that feel that the moon landings were I don't know what they think. It was all a conspiracy.
Soundstage in Hollywood. Happened. Let's be clear.
Yeah, yep. No. When you meet Buzz Aldrin, you wouldn't want to say that to him.
No, I believe he punched somebody in the face for suggesting it to him.
Which he did. Well, I mean, if you think about it, they put their lives on the line. But not only that, they lost a lot of their friends because in order to get to the point of being able to create a rocket like the Saturn V and get people to the moon, there were fatalities along the way.
Oh, and some horrendous ones. I mean, the oxygen fire in Gemini was awful. When is the launch, Niamh? What time today?
Well, it's, I'm just looking at the countdown as I speak. The clock is saying right now 1 hour, 29 minutes. So that's when there'll be a go, no go. So there's a window of between 8:30 and 10:30 here. So that's 1:30 to 3:30 your time. So everything is good so far. We had a little bit of an issue at the start. They were filling up the propellant tanks with liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, and the hydrogen was just playing up a little bit. There's a pipe that was just it was heating up too quickly. But they've managed to overcome that now. So we're back on track. So I've been watching now what's going on from the ground, and so far so good. So it's looking good. It's looking like the biggest rocket and the most powerful rocket is about to take off from Earth in just over an hour and a half.
We will keep our fingers crossed. Niamh Shaw, thank you so much. That is Dr. Niamh Shaw, space reporter, educator and podcaster.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.